Somebody said at one point, I mean, or I read it, that equipment had to be brought from Europe, and that it was...
KP Link brought
his
micro equipment.
Yeah. But did I read this in files? The best equipment came from Europe, and either there was a period when it was hard to get it, or it wasn't made in the United States?
Oh, yes, that's true. The more advanced equipment industry started in Europe, and for a long time, special materials were purchased abroad.
When did that change?
Well, that changed gradually, but particularly after World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. But not before then?
I suppose even during the war, technical equipment had to be manufactured here. And, of course, since the war, I suppose we export equipment to other countries. Mm. There are still specialty items which may be purchased elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be surprised if the Japanese weren't competing in
yes.
quite a number of areas.
I'm not sure whether we said all you meant to say about the inbreeding in the department.
Yes, all right. I could run through a list of some mm-hmm. of the people. Marvin Johnson, who was one of Peterson's, was associated with Peterson for many years, went to Prague. Frank Strong was in Switzerland for a while, Zurich.
So we're talking about both inbreeding and students
yes,
going abroad.
Yes, well, Frank Strong got his PhD in the chemistry department and moved over to biochemistry later. And he was sort of the expert on chemistry within the department.
I see.
Hector DeLuca, quite a bit later, went to Cambridge in a tissue culture. The strange
so
way
even
is
after that, the war.
Oh yes, even after the war. Bill Hextra went to Reading, England again. Lardy was in Canada during the war, in Toronto, and worked with a European who was a refugee from Europe.
Mm. Mm.
So this system of going abroad was very much a part of the picture. And I think I mentioned in connection with the Enzyme Institute,
yes.
that E.B. Fred's idea was that with the European labs less available and Wisconsin and American students increasing numbers of Americans mm-hmm. wanted to do postdoctoral work, that Wisconsin was a place where one could set up a postdoctoral institute. The funds the outside funds for the Enzyme Institute came on that argument.
I'll ask you about that mm-hmm. later, I guess. So you mostly got your own students. Were you criticized for this? Oh, incidentally, did other departments send their students to Europe also?
Some of them, I think, but not chemistry, for instance, organic chemistry, for instance, which had many, many students and very good ones. Nearly all of them went into industry.
They're graduate students.
They're graduate.
More than yours.
More than ours, yes. But I really don't know. I would guess that there was more an interchange of faculty people. I remember when Johnson and Wilds were added to the department, they came from two other schools, and comparable Wisconsin people went to other schools. Mm-hmm. There was a pretty good relationship between some of the organic chemistry departments.
Which other ones?
Oh, Illinois was one of the good ones. I think Wiles came from Michigan. Johnson came from Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
But in later years, I had less contact with organics, so I really can't say. But I think it's true that every one of the Wisconsin, let's say of the biochemistry graduates, now on the biochemistry faculty, without exception, they all spent some time postdoctoral in another institution.
Mm-hmm. But most of
them. But Julius Adler, one of the younger ones, spent his years at Stanford.
Yeah.
So.
But most of them were graduate students here.
Yes.
This, in a strong department, this develops a department. In a weak department, it can be disastrous.
Exactly, exactly.
In your department, it worked.
And there was a time when, beginning about the middle 50s or thereabouts, where many of the younger faculty members in the department, there were others had been brought in from elsewhere, and there was really a real movement to stop this inbreeding and of the present people, DeLuca is certainly okay. Harper was the head of the had a joint appointment in our department in nutritional sciences, was the head of nutritional sciences for a while. And of course now the biochemistry department is so diverse that, as they used to say about genetics, one wing can hardly understand the papers written by the other.
Yes, in the book, everybody's cross-listed with somebody,
yes.
Almost everybody
yes.
with some
mm-hmm.
other department or institute.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're still a bit in the 30s, and
mm-hmm.
it does occur to me to wonder, you, I don't know what your opinion of Elvian and Hart as scientists. I gathered, you said that Link was the outstanding, and other people have said that too. I'm just wondering how all these fine graduate students
yes
got
and
trained.
Yes, no. Yeah. If you read the biography of Elvian.
Yes, I did.
You did.
Yes.
I tried to put the emphasis on where the real talent was.
Uh-huh.
And he was somebody who could sit in on a committee meeting and people would talk around the subject and he would make a suggestion and then the arguments would go on for a long, long time, and the conclusion that finally emerged was what Elvian had suggested an hour or two beforehand.
So you think he
and,
was...
And not because he pounded the table and insisted on his way of doing it, but he had an amazing facility for taking a group of facts and seeing the next logical step.
Does this make him a great scientist?
Apply it to scientific problems, yes. It is a very useful, I don't know what you mean by great. I think there were people who would say that many times what Elvian did were small steps. He was a very good organizer. The nicotinic acid recognition came as a result of activity of quite a few people,
mm-hmm.
and he was the guiding spirit in the whole thing. He managed many things at once at a time when vitamin B complex was, seemed like a tangled mess, and ultimately clarity emerged, and he had a good deal to do with this. I suppose there are different kinds of brilliance, and Link, as a spectacular speaker, personality, was very different from Elvin, and Steinbach was also different from the other two.
If one were to rank them as scientists, or can't you do that?
I wouldn't want to do that.
All right.
Each one made real, substantial contributions. Mm. And more than once, so it obviously was not a lucky shot in the dark.
Yeah. I still would like you to say what you said about salaries and the way Hart ran the department, which is interesting, and I think is characteristic of the university at the time.
But oh yes.
Could you describe
Hart was the chairman, and He prepared the departmental budget, and this involved salaries, and this wasn't anybody else's business. And this must have been the practice, I would suppose, until maybe about 1930, when Steinbach and Peterson were of sufficient stature that they at least wanted to know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But faculty meetings that I had any contact with did not involve people's salaries.
Mm-hmm.
There were very spirited discussions on whether somebody should be added to the staff as an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, these were the qualifications of people that we all knew, whether this was the time to promote this man was what the argument was about, and what his function would be as an independent investigator. Actually, in many cases, the new man was associated with an older one.
Uh-huh.
LVM was associated with Hart, and Johnson was associated with Peterson. My association with Steinbach was not quite so strong, because when I came back from Europe, I was assigned to the cancer problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I was housed in physiology for 2 years and came back to biochemistry to teach Steinbach's courses, and had some space of my own, partly in the Steinbach area, but with the understanding that I could continue with the cancer problem. And much of my work was done, at first, all of it, with Harold Rush,
mm-hmm.
and some of his people. So once again, we had four authors on a published paper. Then later on, as I remained in biochemistry and taught the vitamins course, why my research tended to move over in the direction of the materials that I had to be ahead of in connection with my teaching program.
I'm trying to get the time very straight. You, when you would have been in the department in the position to go to faculty meetings,
I became an assistant professor in 1941.
So you weren't really in the 30s. You wouldn't have been going to...
No, I did not go to faculty.
When did Hart die?
In the early 50s.
Ah, I see. So all through the 40s, he was the chairman.
He became chairman until 44, I think. He had to... I remember the meeting very well when... he told us that you can check his years. A chairman had to retire the chairmanship at age 69. And he retired as a professor at 70. So when he knew that he was going to retire, so this must have been 1940, 43, because he was born in 75, so that would have been 45 when he retired. So this must have been 1 year before giving up the chairmanship. He once told us in faculty meeting that he would have to retire as chairman the end of the year, and we would undoubtedly be asked to vote on who our choice of chairman would be. As a matter of fact, that this system was in effect in the 30s, even in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
We would get a notice from the dean and an envelope to go directly to the dean with a statement, my choice for chairman for the biochemistry for the following year is.
Huh.
And this was a joke as far as we were concerned, because Hart was chairman and that was it, and nobody wanted to change
yeah.
the chairmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he did retire, Elvium had been actually carrying out functions of the chairmanship. He was so closely connected with Hart that there just was no doubt at all as to who the next chairman was going to be and who it should mm-hmm. be.
Was there any discussion of it?
Oh, there was, Elvium was the heir apparent, and
mm-hmm.
Discussion was kind of... Incidentally, light on how E.B. Fred operated.
Mm-hmm.
I heard this later. He first went to Peterson as the oldest professor, and in effect said, would you like to be chairman? Or I am assuming that you don't really want to be bothered with the chairmanship.
Uh-huh.
And who do you think would be the best man? And then he went to Steenbach and
yeah.
said the same thing. And
huh.
so the older staff people and...
That's nice. So they didn't feel neglected.
Link was senior to Elvium at that time. And one of the first things Elvium did as chairman was to appoint a committee of the three elders to be the budget committee.
So they would have a say in salaries.
I understand that they didn't particularly want to be bothered.
Hmm.
But at least the opportunity, the door was open.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, Elvium became dean of the graduate school not so many years after he was chairman, and he actually retained both jobs. So much departmental business had to be done by committees at that time. But Elvium's contacts in the university as a whole were such that one was perfectly happy to let him arrange such things as salaries.
Mm-hmm. You were saying,
and we never really knew who was getting what.
Yeah.
And immediately after the war, there were a good many people. There was a great deal of expansion and in hiring people, there was a great deal of discussion whether one man's talents or particular expertise was preferable to somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
But on the salary question, that was up to the chairman and the dean.
You were saying something about that you had to, if it was necessary to pay somebody a lot of money to get them in.
Yes.
And what was it, Elvium who said, well, that's all right, we have to have him, or how did that go?
This was during the later Elvium years when we began to bring in people from other places. The argument was simply that we want the best man we can get, mm-hmm. and it is up to the chairman and the dean to negotiate a salary which will get him,
mm-hmm.
and which will bring him.
Yeah.
And implied in that was that the new man might be brought in at a very substantial salary if that was necessary.
You said
but during that period, the salaries automatically went up because there was a demand for younger people,
yeah.
of academic quality.
You said you were given a sizable salary raise to keep you from going somewhere else, and
yes.
then you noticed that you didn't get
any raises,
raises
for a
subsequent
while.
Years.
But that was all right. Yeah. That was a sort of a temporary bonus, but. In time, I'm sure I was handled like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk about your awareness, for one thing, of Worf in the background as really sort of must have thought of it as a fairy godmother to an
exactly.
extent of biochemistry.
Oh yes, exactly. One thing, that even goes back to my graduate student days. When the patents on irradiated milk, when irradiation of milk itself was the means of adding vitamin D,
mm-hmm.
This was a big money maker. And to control the product, the government labs were not equipped to run biological assays on vitamin A activity. And so the Alumni Foundation set up a laboratory of their own, and their licensees had to pay for periodic analysis of samples of their product, which were bought at the open market.
Hmm.
And the first man involved in this was actually had the desk in the laboratory, the lab bench, opposite of mine.
Hmm.
This was done in the biochemistry building to begin with,
hmm.
and then when the Worf lab was started, that was where where these analyses were made. And also the Worf lab was a place that hired biochemists before there were jobs anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these people ended up in, ultimately, in very good commercial jobs. Might mention two of them. Both became presidents of the Wisconsin Alumni Association. One was a man by the name of Keenan, who was one of Elgin's people, who started as an employee in the foundation.
You mean in Worf?
In Worf, yes,
yeah.
In Worf, and then later on moved to an industrial job and
mm-hmm.
became prominent nationally
mm-hmm.
in alumni
affairs. What's his first name?
He was Art Keenan as a student, but it's John Arthur is his name. And the other one was Carl Krieger, who was been involved in, he went to Campbell Soup and became a vice president and ultimately president of the Wisconsin Alumni Association as well.
Is he the one that wrote the biography of Steenbach?
No, that was Howard Schneider.
Schneider, yeah. Okay.
But yes, the Worf fellowships were a godsend, and particularly in keeping PhDs on the campus.
Mm.
For instance, I got my PhD in 1933, and the 32 PhDs on both in biochemistry and in chemistry proper, without exception, were still on the campus.
Uh-huh.
There were no jobs for any of these people, and some of them were really top people. And the fellowship paid very little think it was less than $100 a month. But if this kept body and soul together, and the people were able to continue with research work and continue in an academic environment. Mm. So when you say fairy godmother, yes, that was very much the case.
Did you feel that your department would get them, it got any special treatment because of Steenbach? And
I don't think so. At that time, E.B. Fred was the dean was the graduate dean, and he was very much involved in the administration of, in the handling of ag funds. And his argument and his basic philosophy was that the funds should go to the departments which could use them most mm-hmm. effectively. Mm-hmm. And then Steenbach personally, of course, was, was handled in a special way. In one sense he was, in another he wasn't. Mm-hmm. He insisted that the allotment of graduate students who were on war fellowships unassigned were handled by a departmental committee, and that he had no special claim on any of mm-hmm. them. But he did, of course, get some of them. Mm-hmm. How much he had in the way of war funds that came through the graduate school, I don't believe I ever knew. We were more aware of the funds which came through his own private route, mm-hmm. which I think I explained beforehand, were handled. These were part of what he should have received as his share of the patent money, his personal share of the patent mm-hmm. money, which was actually held by the foundation and then used by him mm-hmm. for laboratory expenses, mm-hmm. including salaries.
You didn't have to apply for these grants. You were, did you?
No, yes, we did, to the graduate school.
You fill out a form? Or?
Yes, some of my research assistants, for instance, were supported by a fellowship from the graduate school.
Now that's in the 40s.
This is in the 40s, before then. Yes, I had my first graduate assistant. I became an assistant professor in 39. That did not involve tenure. But I did have a graduate student who started his research work mm-hmm. then. And he was, his first year, he was on a graduate school fellowship, and that mm-hmm. was WARF mm-hmm. money. Then later on, he took on a teaching assignment, and he was paid from departmental funds, and mm-hmm. The cancer project, which came from the graduate school, that money went to the next man, the next graduate student that was hired.
But would he apply, or would you, for him?
No, in that, for the student?
Yeah.
Oh no, the professor applied. The professor applied, the student did not. Later on, when there were, after the war, when there were national fellowships through the National Science Foundation and mm-hmm. later on through National Institutes of Health,
yes.
many of those applications went directly from the student to the granting agency. Mm-hmm. We usually had students do that after, for maybe their third year. We supported them the first years, and then their application to the national organization could involve proof of accomplishment.
Yeah.
And so in general, our students fared very well in applying. Yeah. And the big advantage of the outside grants was that they included family supports, and so post-war mm-hmm. people were older, and many of them had families, and or were developing families, and so the outside support was very welcome.
Yeah.
But then immediately, back to Wharf, immediately after the war, there was a big grant of from the foundation to the graduate school, specifically for fellowships for returning veterans.
Oh. Now, did you
and
ask
these
for
you
that?
See these you see supplemented so-called GI money.
Is that something that the department thought of and asked Wharf for, or?
No, that I think was E.B. Fred's idea, and probably with many, after consulting many people, because that was the other aspect of E.B. Fred's way of operating. He always consulted. He was accused of consulting everybody but the janitor. But, items.
About your own work, did you at any point have to apply for a grant, either from the graduate school, or were you working with people on who already had big grants?
Oh, I, like everybody else, I had to apply elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I had grants from the American Cancer Society, for example, and I had many grants from the National Institutes of Health.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there were fellowship, well, when there was more fellowship money available, then sometimes you needed to apply for additional funds for supplies and equipment for that individual.
Mm-hmm.
So that, yes, the writing of reports and applying for money was very much a part of a professor's life. I sort of stopped when I, in 1966, when I went to Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a number of people finishing up and one or two who were joint majors whose work could be taken care of by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 60 years old at the time and was asked to go to Peru. And I thought, well, some of my own graduate students were doing more advanced work than I was. What I had to offer in a different environment would be more important than just another biochemist in a department that was full of nutritional biochemists.
Was it a wise decision?
It was a very interesting one, yes. And I actually stayed for 3 years. I was in a college of agriculture and sort of attached to the dean's office. And I had to learn Spanish, and I gave seminars, and I even taught a course and in Spanish. And this was quite an experience, I can assure you. But these were younger faculty people, and sometimes I wasn't quite sure of a word, and I'd sort of hesitate, and they would blurt it out. And,
I wanted to know whether it was a strain applying for grants. Were you ever turned down? Did you have to work very hard to get just the right wording, or was it a pretty automatic thing?
No, it wasn't now automatic. And incidentally, I spent a great deal of time on national committees which had to review these applications, and that was really a chore. And I had to, one was a 3-year stint originally for the National Cancer Society, and then a 3-year stint with NIH, originally on more general biochemistry, was called a metabolism study section.
Mm-hmm.
later on, there was a new special nutrition study section, and I was on that for a number of years. Mm. So I had both sides of it. And for a while, it was relatively easy, and then the number of applications increased, and the acceptances were a little harder to get. So it did become more of a strain later on.
Did everybody?
And you see the people who had, now the other thing which developed in the 60s was that research professors often had assistants who were postdoc, who already had a doctor's degree.
Yes.
So, for example, Hector DeLuca's group has always had several who got their degrees somewhere else. And in a sense, now our department is doing what the foreign laboratories did for us.
What is the, why did you mention that? What brought it to your mind?
Well, you were talking about financing.
Yes.
And we were also talking about difficulties and strains.
Yes.
I guess it was the word strain.
Yeah.
Because every 4 years, your best assistant, when you had graduate students, every 4 years, your best people left.
Yeah.
And you had to start over. And if you wanted to continue the same problem, you were starting a relatively untrained individual on that problem. Mm-hmm. And in other laboratories, maybe your competitors had somebody working on that problem with postdoctoral assistants rather than with a first-year graduate student. So this was particularly obvious, for instance, in the cancer problem. When McArdle consisted of only three people and I was one of them, then our assistants were part of the family. And then when I moved to biochemistry, Harold Rush had some assistants and I had some, and we collaborated. But gradually McArdle grew, and the people who were hired were Van Potter, Jim Miller, Elizabeth Miller, both my people, by the way, and they continued at a very high level of activity and on pretty much the same problems that I was interested in. And it wasn't quite fair to expect a new graduate student to be competing with them, so the professor, in this case me, had to decide on a problem in the area which was attainable by a new man, and those problems couldn't always be the things that postdocs were working on elsewhere. So the postdoc element in research groups was a factor
in how research. And it meant you did better research.
Yes, of course, of course, yes.
So you really had to choose between whether you were
training people. Yes, exactly.
Or getting your own research.
And so, for instance, when you were talking about a while ago about Elvium's group, Elvium had many, many people which he started as incoming graduate students. Once he became dean, Alf Harper took over the day-by-day management of his research team. But Elvium still knew what was going on and still was a part of it. Elvium never, he had some postdocs, but not very many. But it was the younger people who came in later who developed who almost preferred postdocs. The people in the Enzyme Institute, for example, operated primarily with postdocs. David Green, I don't think, ever had a graduate student. His lab team of laboratory workers were all PhDs, mainly from somewhere else. Henry Lardy had PhDs always, but usually had one or two graduate students. And they were very able and special people because they had to compete with people who were more experienced than they were. So that as research is done in biochemistry has changed through the years.
So how did this affect you? Did it, I mean, what you're saying that people...
Well, I actually had to change, I would say that one problem led into another. I never really broke, stopped research on, and dreamt up a brand new area. But let me back up a step. Our PhD theses usually consisted of three or four chapters or special sections, each of which might be the basis of a published paper. And every student I had either always did some animal work and always had to have a chemically oriented problem as well, because much animal work was very time consuming and it would take a long time. You had to feed an animal for a long time before the thing developed which you wanted to observe. In the meantime, the man fed his animals for about an hour, but he had the rest of the day to do something else. And this was a chemical problem related to his feeding problem. But then results emerged which pointed to other areas of research. So there was a period of time when my laboratory was involved in microbiological assays for amino acids and for some of the vitamins. And we were more interested in what happened to foodstuffs within the animal body. That, I think, was the thread through all of the research which came out of my department. And of course, vitamins were, this involved vitamins and it involved proteins. And ultimately, minerals. For example, one of the joint majors had been working on vitamin E and and it turned out that the mineral selenium had a good deal to do with what one observed in vitamin E deficiency. And this was a new area, and the next graduate student worked on selenium, was very successful, and his research gave way to four more problems on selenium. So the last research group was mainly on selenium. And the key man in that group was Howard Ganther, who now is on the faculty in the Department of Nutrition, not in biochemistry. There was a period of time when we were working on sterols, some of the, not on cholesterol itself, but on some of the related compounds. And that was a very good chemical problem and was very productive and was sort of ancillary to the cholesterol problem, but really didn't have anything to do with heart disease. But that was supported from NIH funds, and some of those people also had fellowships of their own. So I suppose looking back on my career, I would say maybe the men and women who emerged from it are the single most important element. We published nearly 200 papers. So they undoubtedly contributed something. But many of my people have very good jobs now.
So you're saying
have done well subsequently. Yeah. So I have no apologies for the training that these people got, or if you want to be real conservative, it was obvious that some very talented people were not spoiled while they were with us.
But are you saying that the best thing you accomplished was training?
I think
people?
So.
Mm-hmm. And in
and we started with very select and talented people, and they produced research. And some of them have continued for the rest of their academic careers on what was started as graduate students. The two Millers are a case in point. One of the nutritional people became the head of the Army nutritional laboratories, and ran a very big show. It was very productive. We had some very capable women among the home ecs, and they have given a good account of themselves in academic.
Would you have stayed on, do you think, at McArdle if you hadn't had to go back and teach steam bus courses?
I might have, yes. This was I certainly was, even while I was with Harold Rush, the work done on the cancer problem all had a nutritional aspect to it. Mm-hmm. And much of it involved exposing animals to carcinogenic agents and then modifying the diet and determining whether the development of tumors was accelerated or slowed down. Mm-hmm. And that was the general. Now, much of that work actually had, I think the results which we observed were certainly reproducible, but the carcinogenic agents, some of them, are altered in the body. And what happens to that carcinogenic agent depends on how well the animal is fed or what else is done. So diet, except a high or low calorie diet, does not really make much difference as far as a cancer is concerned that is already in existence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I suppose we are all exposed to low concentrations of very many different compounds which can be carcinogenic in higher concentrations. And it may well be that what we eat may determine whether one or another of these substances is destroyed more rapidly, or on the wrong side of the story, whether it is converted to an active compound more easily.
Yes, it's crucial.
So the dietary factor, there is a dietary factor, but the present organic diet cultists claim that you can do a lot of things which I simply don't believe, and for which there isn't any evidence.
Mm-hmm. I guess some questions have to do with how much, how you perceived the research committee, how important it was. Was it merely a source of money? This is the graduate school research committee. Mm-hmm. Was it merely a source of money? Was it important who was on the committee? Did you pretty much always get what you wanted?
Actually, I had no contact with the committee here. These committees were made up by representatives from all parts of the campus. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the committee member, I remember one of my projects, well, the cancer project, a man came to interview me on it, and it was Selig Perlman. And I told him what we were doing.
Yeah.
And when he got through, he said, well, if they sent an innocent like me to interview you, I don't think you have to worry about whether it will be approved. Uh-huh. But I'm sure there were cases where knowledgeable people did look at the proposals.
Do you think this wasn't a good idea to send somebody from the
Yes. Oh, no, but in contrast to the way the national committees operated, those committees were made up of well-known people, and for instance, on the committees that I served, there were always medical people, and there was usually a statistician who worked with biological phenomena. Mm-hmm. In other words, various areas of expertise related to the central function of this committee.
Yeah.
And so these were supposed to be informed opinions. The people who voted on the projects at the national level. Now, there must have been projects within the university that came to the university committee that someone had his doubts about. The problems in later years were rather, maybe the dean would say something like, isn't this something for which you can get funds from the outside?
Uh-huh.
And particularly once Bob Bach became graduate dean, he had funds were not so available, and he had to make sure that what could come from the outside did come from the outside. Mm-hmm. And very often Wisconsin grants were made as kind of insurance in case one of the other grants did not come through.
Mm-hmm.
In later years, there was often the situation where a grant would be approved, but there wouldn't be funds available to fund it.
Mm.
This is from the national level.
And then would you hope to get some from the
local
research committee?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have thought of a specific question still on the department before we get into the general university, and that is the whole furor over Carl Paul Link's desire to have vitamin K included in aspirin and Steenbach's opposition to making that possible except in prescription drugs. I think that's the way it works.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
That isn't my impression. I don't know. Was Steenbach? You might know this if you've looked
I've
through.
I've just been reading newspaper clippings. And
No, it's always seemed to me that the combination of vitamin K and aspirin was a good idea, because it certainly is clear that chemically some of the salicylic acid derivatives arise from dicumarol,
mm-hmm.
and they have some of the properties of Di Kumro. Wasn't the, this is Link's argument,
yeah,
that
I,
when Link's warfarin patent was turned over to the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, he in effect wiped his hands of the problem and said the licensing, the commercial use of it, the handling of the money is up to them. He would not let, he would not be involved in that. And privately, he said, look what too much involvement did to Steenbach. So I think Link was absolutely right in promoting the use of vitamin K. In fact, it was a rather important discovery, because in rheumatic fever, the treatment of choice was very large doses of aspirin for many years. Mm-hmm. And the medical literature contains many references to poor coagulation of the blood of patients with rheumatic fever. And it was always assumed that this coagulation defect was part of the disease, when, as a matter of fact, it was the result of the treatment. So certainly for, as far as I know, it is still approved practice of anyone taking a great deal of aspirin to take vitamin K as well.
I've never heard of it. According to this, it just that put an end to it. It wasn't passed by the Warren trustees. And when we finished, I'll show you the article.
Yes.
I think I can find it again.
Well, there's something else. In recent years, I've just been taking vitamin pills. I'm old enough for that now.
Mm-hmm.
But when I used to be,
me too.
When I was sometimes interviewed or would get a phone call on what I thought of vitamin pills, and my answer would be, well, I've taught the graduate course in vitamins for so many years and I don't take them myself.
Yeah.
I believe in a well-balanced diet. But I think as you get older, they're to be on the safe side. Why, it's a wise thing to do. But I've noticed that the multivitamin tablets that I have right now do not contain any vitamin K.
Mm-hmm.
And just as there is, one can get too much vitamin A, or and there's vitamin D toxicity, and
yeah.
K has some adverse effects if you take too much. I suppose that's the reason K is not in the in the multivitamin tablet. The other one that is missing is folic acid, and that can have, in some cases can increase the need for vitamin B12 or aggravate some other symptoms. I don't think it's that serious, but just to be on the safe side, that is omitted from vitamin. But it seems to me that the combination of K and aspirin is just the right thing, because if somebody only takes a few aspirins, the amount of vitamin K will not hurt him. And if he takes very many aspirin pills, then maybe he does need some more vitamin K. But the warfarin patent, the real money-making aspirin aspect of that is the rat killing,
yes,
the rodenticide.
Yeah. And also there's a statement that E.B. Fred blocked Link's research on the cause of calf scours. This was in 1952.
Oh yes, there was some argument. Link had some idea, and he actually had it tested, I think, at North Carolina, because he claimed that he couldn't get cooperation here. And
but you don't know what it was about.
The real details, I don't exactly know what...
He was censured by the Regents, Link was, yes, at that point. It seems puzzling. I mean, why would Fred have objected to it?
Link, no, but there was... Link, when he did something, he always did it with quite a flair, and everybody knew what he was doing and saying. And he was temperamentally inclined to be disrespectful to chairmen and deans, yes, and presidents.
But still,
for instance, this was a plus on the Link side. After Pearl Harbor, when the Japanese in California were interned, the chemistry department at California Tech wrote to some of their personal friends in behalf of their ablest Japanese students. Mm-hmm. And Link accepted one of them. And President Dykstra objected very strongly. And there was a real row. And Dykstra's argument was that the other students would be incensed and this individual might be abused. Well, as it turned out, Mike Ikawa was a very self-effacing type of individual personally. Whether he always was that way, but he certainly, when he arrived, he said his objective was to be as inconspicuous as possible. He got along very well with the other graduate students in his department. He knew in the Link group better than anybody else. I had him in class. He took coursework everywhere else. He was an absolute top student. And he was the key man in the actual synthesis of warfarin. Gee. And his name is on the patent.
Gee, that is something. What a story.
So, along with Link's cantankerousness, there was the other side. Mm-hmm.